Welcome back to Cyber Mornings Daily. So glad to have you with us for another deep dive into the, well, the wild world of cybersecurity.
It's always eventful, isn't it? The digital landscape just keeps throwing new challenges and honestly, some pretty surprising developments our way.
Absolutely. And today we're unpacking some truly fascinating recent findings that really hit close to home. They touch on technologies you probably use every single day.
Yeah, think of this as your shortcut to getting your head around some really cutting-edge security news.
Exactly. We've got three distinct stories lined up. They're all pretty intriguing in their own right.
That's right. First, we'll look at, a very clever tactic a researcher used to guess Google phone numbers.
Ooh, okay.
Then we'll dig into why Microsoft is putting the brakes on certain email attachments in Outlook.
Always relevant. And the third.
And third, something brand new and maybe a little scary. A new type of vulnerability found in AI assistants. We're talking Microsoft 365 Copilot here.
Wow. Okay. That covers a lot of ground, from legacy stuff to like bleeding edge AI.
It really shows how attackers are finding weaknesses, well, everywhere. Old systems, new systems, you name it.
Let's jump in then. We'll explore the technical bits and, you know, what these discoveries tell us about staying safe online. All right. Let's kick things off with story number one. This is about a security researcher who was poking around Google's account recovery system.
Right. And what they found was pretty startling. A way to potentially uncover the recovery phone number for, well, pretty much any Google account.
And that recovery number, for most of us, that is our main phone number, isn't it?
Usually, yes. Your primary mobile number. And what's really striking here is how they did it. It wasn't some super complex modern system they targeted.
No. What was it then?
The core vulnerability was actually in a legacy, specifically a JavaScript-disabled version of Google's username recovery form, an old pathway.
Like an old service entrance, you mean? Something forgotten?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't have the robust modern security checks, things like proper rate limiting that you'd absolutely expect today.
So the researcher realized they could use this old form to make queries, like ask it questions.
Exactly. They could essentially ask, hey, does this phone number I'm giving you belong to a Google account with the display name, say, John Smith?
Okay, but hold on. To find any number, you can't just check one by one. You'd need to check millions, maybe billions of numbers. Wouldn't Google systems just shut that down instantly?
Ah, yes. That's where the really clever technical steps come in. To get around the basic rate limiting on that, that aging form, the researcher used IPv6 address rotation.
IPv6 rotation, meaning lots and lots of IP addresses.
Lots is an understatement. By controlling vast ranges of IPv6 addresses, we're talking about generating literally trillions of unique IPs using standard 64 subnets. They can make almost every request look like it was coming from a completely different place.
Trillions. Okay, yeah, that blows past any simple rate limit checking for source IPs. But what about CAPTCHAs? Surely there were CAPTCHAs, the things designed to stop bots.
There were, but they found a way around those too. And this part, honestly, is quite ingenious. So the modern JavaScript-enabled version of the form did use Google's BotGuard CAPTCHAs.
Yeah.
The researcher figured out, okay, I can go to the modern form, solve the CAPTCHA, get a valid BotGuard token,
right,
and then take that valid token and use it in the request they were sending to the old vulnerable Node.js form.
Wait, so they used the new security system's validation token to authenticate requests against the old insecure system.
You got it. It basically tricked the old system.
Yeah.
It thought the request had passed the modern security check because it had a valid token.
That's, wow. That's beautifully devious, actually.
It really highlights, you know, how security layers need to be consistent everywhere, across all versions of a service, old and new.
So, okay. Rate limiting bypassed with IPv6, CAPTCHAs bypassed using the token trick. What next?
Next, they built a tool, a specialized brute forcing tool they called GPB. This thing could just hammer the old endpoint, rapidly testing phone numbers.
How rapidly?
It used libraries, like Google's own lib phone number, to iterate through numbers in the correct format for each country, filtering out false positives along the way. And the speed, well, they estimated hitting maybe 40,000 requests per second.
40,000 a second, so finding a number.
Was potentially very fast. For U.S. numbers, maybe around 20 minutes to brute force the possibilities if you had a partial hint. U.K. numbers, maybe 4 minutes.
And smaller countries.
Places like the Netherlands, less than 15 seconds. It's really concerning speed.
Disturbingly fast. But, okay, you still need a starting point, right? You mentioned needing the display name, like John Smith, and you'd need the target's email, plus maybe a hint about the number itself.
Good points. Yes, the attack needed the target's email address first. Now, Google's made emails less public, but the researcher found this neat trick using Google's Looker Studio.
Looker Studio? How does that help?
Apparently, if you create a Looker Studio document and then try to transfer ownership to a target's Gmail address, even if they don't accept or interact, their Google display name would pop up on your dashboard.
Ah, so you link an email to a name that way. Clever. Okay, email and name acquired. But how do you narrow down the phone number search? You can't check every number on Earth.
You need a lead. And often, Google's own account recovery process gives you one. It usually shows the last two digits of the recovery phone number, right?
Right, you've seen that, like 12.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can get more. Password reset flows in other services, think PayPal, maybe other sites linked to your Google account. Sometimes they show more digits as a hint, like maybe plus 14, 17, 79.
Ah, the classic chaining of information leaks. You use a little scrap of data from here to enable a bigger attack over there.
Precisely. So picture this. An attacker knows your name, gets your email via that Looker Studio trick, finds a partial number, maybe from a password reset hint somewhere else.
Then they could use this old, vulnerable Google form and that GPB tool.
And potentially find your full recovery phone number in just minutes.
Okay, so what's the real... So what here? What's the danger?
The danger is significant. Leaking someone's primary phone number, especially their Google recovery number, is a huge security risk. That number is often the key to SMS verification codes, right?
Yeah, two-factor authentication.
It's used for identity checks. And it's absolute gold for targeted phishing, that's voice phishing, where attackers call you up pretending to be someone legit to trick you.
Or worse, SIM swapping.
Or worse, yes, SIM swap attacks, where they try to convince your mobile carrier to port your number over to their SIM card. If they succeed, they intercept all your calls, all your texts, including those critical verification codes.
Which could lead to losing access to, well, everything. Bank accounts, crypto, email. Anything tied to that number, that is a serious threat.
It absolutely is.
So how did Google react when the researcher told them about this? This was back in April 2025, right?
Correct. Reported in April. Initially, Google apparently assessed the risk as low. Maybe they thought exploiting it was harder in practice.
But the researcher showed it wasn't that hard with the IP rotation and KEPI TCHA bypass.
Yeah. Exactly. After getting more details, particularly about the brute force potential, Google upgraded the severity rating to medium in late May. They put in some temporary fixes pretty quickly.
And the researcher got paid.
Yes, they received a $5,000 reward through Google's bug bounty program.
$5,000 for potentially exposing, well, a lot of primary phone numbers globally feels maybe a bit light given the potential impact.
Bounty amounts, you know, they can vary a lot. Depends on the company's policy, the perceived exploitability, the blast radius.
Yeah.
Lots of factors. Mm. While $5,000 might seem modest to some for this kind of finding, the really critical thing is the fix.
Did they fix it properly?
Yes. Google confirmed they fully deprecated, meaning they shut down that vulnerable Node.js recovery endpoint completely in early June 2025. So that specific attack path is now closed.
Okay, good to know it's fixed. But wow, what a stark reminder. Security isn't just about the shiny new defenses. You've got to keep an eye on the old back doors, too.
Absolutely. Attackers will always probe for the path of least resistance, even if it's a dusty, forgotten trail.
Okay, so moving on from old Google systems, let's talk about something else we all deal with daily, email attachments. Story number two is about Microsoft Outlook getting stricter.
That's right. Microsoft recently announced they're adding two new file types to the list of automatically blocked attachments. This applies to Outlook on the web and the new Outlook for Windows client, and it starts this July.
Two specific file types. Which ones are they, and why suddenly block them now? Most people probably haven't even heard of them.
The file types are .library-ms and .search-ms. And you're absolutely right, they're not common for everyday users. But attackers found ways to abuse them. They have a history.
A rap sheet, you might say. Tell us their story. Why are they dangerous?
They definitely have a story. Let's start with .library-ms. These are essentially Windows library files. They just define collections of folders for organizing stuff in Windows Explorer.
Okay, sounds harmless enough.
You'd think so. But earlier this year, attackers started using them in phishing emails. The goal was to exploit a specific Windows vulnerability, CVE-2025-24054. Sending a malicious .library-ms file could trick the system into exposing NTLM hashes from the victim's computer when they interacted with it.
Exposing NTLM hashes, oh, that's bad, right? That helps attackers crack passwords or impersonate users.
Exactly. NTLM hashes are a form of stored credential information. If attackers get hold of them, they can try to crack them offline or use them in other attacks like pass the hash to move around a network. It's a classic credential theft technique.
Nasty. Okay, so that's .library-mzs. What about the other one, .search-ms?
Search-ms files have been abused for even longer, since at least 2022. These files use a specific Windows feature, a URI protocol handler, to basically force a Windows search window to pop open automatically on the recipient's computer, pointing to a remote location controlled by the attacker.
Just pops open a search window? How is that dangerous?
By itself, it might just be annoying. But attackers chained it with other exploits. Remember the Felina vulnerability. The Windows Support Diagnostic Tool, MSDT, Remote Code Execution Flaw, CVE-2022-0190.
Vaguely, yeah. That allowed running code, right?
Right. So attackers would use the .search-ms file to trigger the search window pointing to their malicious server and then leverage something like the Felina bug or similar flaws to execute malicious code, basically. Install malware often just by the user interacting with that seemingly innocent search window or sometimes just by previewing the email.
Wow. So just previewing an email with one of these attached could potentially lead to malware? That's a pretty low bar for infection.
It is.
Uh-huh.
And that's why Microsoft is acting. This move to block them, though, it's not just a one-off reaction. It fits into a much bigger picture.
You mean Microsoft's broader strategy to clamp down on older, risky features?
Exactly. We've seen a pattern here, haven't we? They've been blocking VBA macros by default in Office files from the internet. They disabled the old XLM macros. They started blocking XLL add-ins. Just recently, they announced a VBScript is being deprecated. And back in April, they disabled ActiveX controls in Office apps.
Right. It's like they're systematically cleaning house, removing features that maybe aren't used much legitimately anymore, but are constantly being abused by attackers.
That's precisely it. It's about reducing the overall attack surface. Why leave these potential entry points open if the vast majority of users don't need them, but attackers love them?
Makes perfect sense from a security perspective. So how will blocking these two file types actually affect regular users? Will most people even notice?
Honestly, for the vast, vast majority of users, no impact whatsoever. You've probably never intentionally sent or received a .library-ms or .search-ms file.
Mm.
If you happen to get one after July, you just won't see it as an attachment you can download or open in Outlook Web or the new client.
Okay. But what about those, you know, one in a million cases? Someone in an organization who has some specific, maybe legacy reason to use these files?
That's a fair question. Technically, IT administrators managing their organization's Outlook settings can adjust the OWA mailbox policies to allow these file types again. But Microsoft strongly advises against doing that because of the known security risks.
So what should those users do instead?
The better, safer alternatives are things like putting the file inside a password-protected zip archive first, maybe temporarily changing the file extension before sending and telling the recipient to change it back, or, ideally, using secure cloud sharing platforms like OneDrive or SharePoint.
Which is generally better practice anyway for sharing anything that might be even slightly risky. So it sounds like a sensible, proactive move by Microsoft, driven by actual attacks they've observed in the wild.
It really is. It's defense in depth, closing known doors that attackers have been kicking open.
All right, so we've covered legacy Google systems and slightly obscure but abused Windows file types. Now let's jump to the absolute cutting edge. Artificial intelligence. Our third story today introduces something really quite new and frankly a bit unsettling, a vulnerability in Microsoft 365 Copilot.
Yes, this one is definitely significant. Researchers have dubbed it Echo Leak. And what makes it stand out is that it's being called the first known zero-click AI vulnerability.
Zero-click. Okay, that phrase always makes ears perk up in cybersecurity circles. It means an attack can happen without the victim doing anything wrong, right? No clicking bad links, no opening malicious files. And now we're seeing this concept applied to AI.
Exactly. And the specific type of flaw here is called an LLM scope violation.
Hmm.
Essentially, it means the large language model, the AI brain at the heart of Copilot, gets tricked into leaking sensitive internal data that it should have access to for its job, but that it should never send outside, all without the user asking it to or even knowing it's happening.
Okay, this is starting to sound like something out of a sci-fi plot. How does Echo Leak actually work? Can you walk us through the story of this attack?
Let's trace the chain of events. It starts quite subtly. An attacker sends a specially crafted email to the target user.
Okay, a malicious email. Standard stuff so far.
But here's the twist. The email might look perfectly normal on the surface. Maybe it's just generic spam, maybe slightly more targeted phishing bait. The visible text seems harmless. The real payload is a hidden prompt injection instruction embedded within the email's text.
Hidden inside the email text, an instruction meant for the AI, not the human reading it.
Precisely. It's crafted specifically to manipulate the LLM later. Now, here comes the zero-click part. The user doesn't need to open that specific email. They don't need to click any malicious link in it. They just go about their normal workday using Microsoft 365 Copilot for legitimate tasks.
Like asking it to summarize a meeting or find information on a project?
Exactly. Let's say the user asks Copilot a question, maybe summarize the key points from the Project Phoenix documents and recent emails. Now, if that malicious email the attacker sent earlier happens to be stored somewhere Copilot can access, maybe it's just sitting in the user's inbox, maybe got our archive, maybe it was mentioned in a Teams chat Copilot can see, and if it's deemed somehow relevant to the user's query.
Relevant how? Just because it contains similar keywords or topics?
Often, yes. It's based on how Copilot's underlying retrieval augmented generation engine, the ORAGesis, works. That RAGI engine is designed to pull in relevant documents, emails, chats, whatever it can find, to give the AI the necessary context to answer the user's question accurately.
So the RAG engine, trying to be helpful, says, oh, this email seems relevant to Project Phoenix, and pulls it into the context it feeds to the AI, inadvertently hinting at the attacker's hidden instruction.
You've got it. That hidden prompt injection is now part of the overall prompt the LLM receives, along with the user's actual question. It essentially hijacks the AI's task. The LLM gets tricked. Instead of just answering the user's question about Project Phoenix, it also follows the attacker's hidden command.
And that command tells it to do what?
The command instructs the LLM to extract sensitive internal data that it has access to, maybe data from other documents, confidential emails, private chats, whatever is within Copilot's permitted scope for that user.
Okay, so the AI has been tricked into grabbing sensitive data, but how does the attacker get that data? Copilot isn't just going to email it out, is it?
No, this is the next really clever part of the attack chain. The manipulated LLM takes the sensitive data it's just extracted, and it cunningly embeds that data into a URL. It might construct a web link, or maybe even an image URL, as part of the response it generates for the user.
It hides the stolen data inside a link in the AI's answer.
Exactly. The researchers found specific ways this could be done, sometimes using particular markdown formats, like for embedding images, to make it look less suspicious.
And because web browsers automatically try to load images or maybe prefetch links shown in a web page?
Bingo. The user's browser, seeing that link or image tag in the AI's response generated within the Copilot interface, automatically makes a request to fetch that URL.
And that request goes to the attacker's server.
Correct. The request sends the full URL, which now secretly contains the sensitive data embedded by the compromised AI, directly to the attacker's controlled server. All of this happens instantly when the AI response is displayed. Zero interaction needed from the user beyond asking their original legitimate question.
Wow. That is incredibly sophisticated. It completely subverts the AI's purpose. It uses the AI's core function, accessing your info and generating helpful responses, and turns it into a data exfiltration tool, completely behind the user's back.
It's a powerful demonstration of a new attack vector.
And I suppose attackers could try to make those malicious URLs look less suspicious too, maybe disguise them.
Yes, that's another layer. While a corporate firewall might block connections to, obviously, dodgy external domains, the researchers noted that the attack could potentially craft these data exfiltrating URLs to use trusted domains. Think about embedding data in parameters added to legitimate-looking Microsoft Teams or SharePoint URLs, which are almost always allowed through firewalls. That makes detection much harder.
The significance here feels huge. This isn't just about tricking a user. It's about manipulating the AI's fundamental logic to actively leak data.
Precisely. Even though this specific echo leak vulnerability was discovered and fixed relatively quickly by Microsoft, and thankfully wasn't exploited in the wild as far as we know, it serves as a critical proof of concept. It demonstrates a whole new class of vulnerability that could be incredibly dangerous for organizations that are integrating AI deeply into their workflows, especially those handling sensitive data.
It really shows how traditional security defenses, firewalls, endpoint protection might be bypassed if the AI itself becomes the vector.
Exactly. The AI can reach inside the perimeter, grab data, and then be manipulated to send it out in ways that might look like normal traffic.
So how was this discovered and fixed? And what does it tell us about securing AI going forward?
It was discovered by researchers at AIM Labs back in January 2025. Hmm. They followed responsible disclosure practices and reported it directly to Microsoft.
And Microsoft took it seriously.
They did. They acknowledged the severity, assigned it a critical CVE identifier, CVE-2025-32711, and managed to deploy a server-side fix fairly quickly, completing the rollout in May 2025. They also confirmed that no customer data was actually compromised by this specific flaw.
Okay, that's good news. Kudos to the researchers and a commendably fast response from Microsoft, especially for such a novel type of attack. What defenses are needed against this kind of thing? It feels different.
It demands new thinking and new layers of security specifically tailored to LLMs and AI systems. We're talking about things like much stronger prompt injection filters, getting better at detecting and neutralizing those hidden malicious instructions before they even reach the AI model.
So filtering the input more carefully makes sense.
Also, implementing more granular input scoping. This means ensuring the AI only gets access to the absolute minimum amount of data necessary to perform the specific task the user asks for, rather than having broad access to everything.
Least privilege, but for AI data access.
Exactly. And another crucial area is applying filters to the AI's output. We need systems that can scan the response the LLM generates before it's shown to the user, looking for suspicious patterns like sensitive data embedded in URLs, or code-like structures that shouldn't be there, or attempts to make unexpected external network connections.
So basically, we need security layers that are suspicious of both what the AI is told and what the AI says.
That's a good way to put it. And maybe even rethinking how those RA engines work, perhaps making them more cautious about automatically pulling in potentially untrusted content, like external emails, when the AI is working within a context that also includes sensitive internal corporate data. It's a complex challenge, for sure.
But one that's clearly now front and center for AI security research.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've really covered some ground today. Three fascinating and quite different cybersecurity stories. We saw how a researcher used basically a forgotten legacy system at Google to potentially expose sensitive phone numbers.
Right, exploiting the old to attack the new.
Then we looked at Microsoft being proactive, blocking seemingly obscure file types in Outlook, but doing it because attackers had found real nasty ways to weaponize them.
Learning from past attacks to harden the present.
And finally, we explored this truly groundbreaking Echo Leak vulnerability in Microsoft 365 Copilot, a zero-click attack that shows how AI itself can be manipulated into becoming a data theft tool.
Highlighting a whole new frontier of security challenges. Each story really underscores just how relentless and, frankly, how creative attackers can be. They will find the weakest link, whether it's code written decades ago or the absolute latest technology.
And it also highlights the vital, constant effort by security researchers and the tech companies themselves to find these flaws and fix them before widespread damage occurs. It's a continuous cycle.
It truly is an ongoing evolution of offense and defense.
And remember, these aren't just abstract theoretical problems cooked up in a lab. They affect the actual tools and systems you likely interact with every single day. Understanding a bit about how these attacks work, why these vulnerabilities exist, helps you appreciate those invisible layers of security working to protect you.
And it helps explain why sometimes things have to change, like blocking an email attachment type you've never even heard of. It's usually for a very good reason based on real threats.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, here's maybe a final thought to chew on. As these AI assistants, like Copilot, become even more powerful, more integrated, handling more and more of our sensitive personal and corporate data, how fundamentally does security itself need to adapt?
It's a huge question.
It seems like we're moving beyond just securing the user, you know, teaching people not to click bad links. Now, we also have to figure out how to secure the AI from being secretly tricked into doing bad things for the attacker, often without the user having any clue. How do we build AI we can actually trust when the AI itself can become the vulnerability?
That is the question that's going to shape a massive amount of cybersecurity research, development, and strategy in the coming years. No easy answers there yet.
Indeed. A lot to think about. Well, thanks so much for joining us for this deep dive on Cyber Mornings Daily. Stay informed, stay vigilant, and stay safe out there.